Welcome to Masters of the Stage. This SDC Foundation program illuminates the creative processes and personal and professional experiences that guide today's luminary directors and choreographers as they forge artistic careers in a profession that has no handbook. These intimate and dynamic conversations between today's most successful artists offer audiences rare insights into the challenging and ever-changing world of theater making. This episode was recorded at Stage Directors and Choreographers' Offices on May 22, 2019. Director Robert O'Hara interviews SDC Foundation President Sheldon Epps.
So, Sheldon.
Robert.
It's great to be here.
It
How
is.
Did we meet? I don't remember. Do you remember?
I don't.
I just feel like
actually.
I've known you forever.
Yeah. Maybe a TCG conference. Or
probably. But you've always been, when I knew you, well, when I met you, I knew you were running Pasadena.
Yes.
But I want to talk about that later. What I want to talk about first is, I didn't know, I was surprised how many Broadway shows you've done. That was like shocking to me.
Does that seem like a lot?
It felt like a lot of Broadway shows. I want to know, what is your relationship to Broadway now? And in terms, and also when you were directing there, has the culture changed? Are you still in that sort of race of, like, you know, as a Broadway director? Like, what do you think of yourself in terms of Broadway? What is that relationship right now?
Right. I think every show that I did on Broadway came through a not-for-profit theater route. Whether that was the tiny, tiny little off Broadway theater company that I ran in the 80s with some school friends, or the Old Globe, or Pasadena Playhouse. I think every single show came through that route. So, though inevitably, as you work on these things, Broadway comes to mind, it was never the initiating impulse with any Broadway show that I've done. So I've never actually been hired to do a show.
Oh, really?
Specifically to go to Broadway. And most of the things that I've done are things that I've developed in one way or another.
Right.
Conceived the show or worked with another writer or worked on the show as artistic director at Pasadena Playhouse, and then the show moved on.
Interesting.
So I don't necessarily think of myself as a member of that Broadway club, though I've been fortunate enough to have that experience. Now, since I've left the Playhouse and I'm not directly connected with a regional theater on a leadership basis, there start to be more approaches about commercial productions, both off-Broadway and Broadway, and all of that, and having had the experience, you know, inspires interest, I guess.
Yeah, but that's very interesting, because I always would go, you know, all the plays that I've done that were written not by people of color, so plays written by white people, I've never really been offered a play written by a white person.
Really?
It's always been me working with someone or me suggesting myself for something.
Right.
But it's rare that I'll get a call. And I've had this sort of pet peeve for a while, because of course every person of color has a play, they have a long list of white women and white directors or what have you, but it doesn't seem like it has turned around, and that there's a lot of African-American directors directing work by white people. There's some people who are directing Shakespeare, I think,
right.
You know.
Right.
But not new
Interestingly
plays.
Enough, it happens more with classical theater than contemporary theater or American classics.
And it's so strange. It's just so strange.
Very
because
strange.
I don't want to say, you know, oh, you shouldn't be directing this, but I also don't want to, I just think, like, they don't even think of us.
I think that's that's the issue. It's not that they will think of you, or a while ago, think of me. And say, oh, he's a person of color, he's not up to it. The problem is that they simply do not think of you. You know, just does not cross the mind of those in power to make those decisions. I'll tell you a very funny story about it. Years ago, and this is a really interesting story, because years ago, there was an artistic director who actually called me to do Philadelphia Story. Mm. And frankly, at that time, that was so shocking that I said, wait a minute, you want to do a live version of Philadelphia Story? I said, that doesn't really make much sense to me. Mm. He said, no. I want to do the play, and I want you to direct it, and you take somebody with high style and understanding of language and period and all of that. So there are not a lot of those people around, and I think you're the right person to do it. And I said, wow, that is really wonderful of you, because mm-hmm. this was well before the time mm-hmm. that happened, even less than it doesn't happen right. now, if yeah. that makes sense. So I went, I did the production. It was with Stephanie Zimbalist, played mm-hmm. Tracy. The mm-hmm. production was a big success. Mm-hmm. Did very well for the theater. And the following season, or a season later, she called me, same artistic director, called and said, I'd like you to come and do Bo Willie's Black Bottom, or you know, whatever was the black play in that season, you know. And I said, well, I'm flattered. What else are you doing? Mm. And she said, well, we're doing a Chekhov play, and we're doing an Noel Coward play, and we're doing Twelfth Night. Mm. And I said, oh, well, I'd really be much more interested in doing Twelfth Night. Mm-hmm. And she said, that might be a problem.
Really?
And I said, why? You don't think I'm up to do it? She said, oh, no. But if I had you do Twelfth Night, that would mean that I had to have two black directors in the season.
What?
Exactly.
Out someone's mouth, running the American
theater.
And I said,
do you know what you just said?
Oh my God.
Would it ever cross your mind in 100 years to say, is it a problem that I have two white directors in the season? And she literally had not realized that she said it. She didn't realize the implications of what she said. So it's nowhere near as good as it should be.
Yes.
As good as it must be. Mm. But we've made a little bit
that's
of progress.
That.
Yeah. Yeah. Not enough, but a little.
Now, tell me about your entrance into directing. Were you ever writing as well?
No, I was an actor.
You were an actor.
I went to Carnegie Mellon University in the drama department as an actor and graduated as an actor in a very small class because it was a tough school. Mm-hmm. But I made it through. And
were there other people of color in the class?
There are other people of color that started with me as freshmen, but I was the only person of color who graduated in that class.
Interesting.
There were many who followed, and only a few before Michelle Shea being one of them. Not a whole lot. So there was definitely at Carnegie at that time a real interest in trying to diversify the graduating class. Uh-huh. So the fact that I made it was something of a triumph.
So you came out an actor.
I came out an actor. I acted a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, I made a living for the most part and did a lot of regional theater. Did a soap for a little while. Mm. But had that frustration because that was before the big push on that ugly term, non-traditional casting, which I despise that term.
Yeah.
So I was frustrated as an actor and got together with a group of four other people that I'd been to Carnegie with, Norman Renee being the best known of them, and the director fellow of us, and started a company in Chelsea on 18th Street.
Oh, really?
And in our second or third year of running that company, Norman very, very generously came to me and said, you know, when I direct you and we have an argument, I usually think that you are right. I would never admit it at the time, double Scorpio than I am, but I do come around and two or three days later, say, let's try it this way. That's usually what you said. So he very generously said, I think that means you think like a director, and we we have challenges finding directors that we want to work with, so why don't you just try it?
Mm.
And I very modestly tried it first with A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Oh my God.
This tiny little space.
Uh-huh.
And that went well. And then the year after that, I did Blues in the Night,
mm-hmm.
which then kept going and wound up at other theaters and on Broadway and Lynn and all of that. So I never remember making a conscious decision to shift to a directing career. I just found myself
directing.
Making a living as a director and said, okay, I guess I'm a director now, and I like it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I didn't miss, certainly, the audition process. I did not miss.
Did
and
you
I realized
you
that
up?
I loved... Yes, I
you,
did.
You
it
gave
was,
up. You
it
gave
was
up
like
the
giving
acting.
Up smoking.
Oh.
You know, I never had a time when I was directing and acting
I
at
see.
The same time. And I realized that what was more interesting to me, certainly than the repetition that you have to have in a run, was the putting it together,
mm-hmm.
you know, the making it live and breathe and
mm-hmm.
the rehearsal process. So I became a director and never looked back to acting.
And do you think, in terms of Blues in the Night, do you think that that could happen now? That type of trajectory of that play could happen now?
So much harder.
Mm-hmm.
Blues in the Night started literally as a late night cabaret
mm-hmm.
in an 11 o'clock time slot after the show that we were doing as the lead show.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of exploded in this tiny little space. And, you know, after the first couple of performances, everybody's trying to get in.
Mm.
It was a time when there was a big movement of stuff from not just off-Broadway, but off-Broadway
mm.
to Broadway. So, again, it was not vaguely in my mind when we first did it that this was going to become a commercial property. And I don't think it could happen in the same way because the costs are so much greater and the financial pressure is so much greater. Blues in the Night is a cast of four and a band of five.
Mm.
But even at that size now, if you tried to move that as from an off-Broadway situation to Broadway, that would be a $10 million investment.
Yeah.
So no, it couldn't happen
right.
in the same way. So it was a fortunate time. It was a fortunate time also just in terms of running an off-Broadway theater company. I think
right.
our rent in this little loft space was $500 a month.
Really?
You couldn't rent this table for $500 a month now. So, you know, we were able to, the five of us were able to cobble together just a little bit of money
mm.
and get a theater company going
mm.
and exercise our craft and do the work and not worry too much
mm-hmm.
because nobody was losing any money and it didn't take a lot of money to keep it alive.
And were
so,
you...
gone under days, as they say.
Right. Were you ever? Was there ever a moment in that whole Blues of the Night journey in which you felt that there was a possibility of you being pushed out as it moved forward? Or were you always treated as the person that would be moving it forward?
There were some moments when it seemed like it might not happen.
Mm-hmm.
When it felt like maybe the show would not get produced. We went first to a regional theater, which was just too large for the show.
Mm-hmm.
It was 1,200, 1,500 seats, something like that. So the show simply didn't work because it was in too big a theater. But fortunately, that was blamed on the theater, not on me. So I'm aware of what you're talking about. But no, that I don't. If that happened, it happened behind closed doors.
Mm-hmm.
But I never knew about it, so I never experienced that. Thank goodness.
And was so. I'm assuming that there was never a moment where you go, you know what? I think I'm going to go and get an MFA in directing because you were already doing it.
Yeah,
anyway.
That's
yeah.
true. My MFA in directing was...
Was directing.
Directing. Right. Yeah, so...
And what is your take on MFA? I know you've taught in various universities, but do you encourage directors to do that? Or do you encourage directors to go... I mean, every person is like, you know, the idea of starting a theater company is so cliche now, you know, and it's like, you know, there are all these theater companies, and sometimes you go... what exactly is the end? Because sometimes I go, well, this theater company is so that you can direct, right? And this is the entire nature of this theater company, so that we can give you money so that you can do the shows that you want to do.
Yes.
Right? And I always find that to be odd to me, only because I'm a sort of freelance director.
Right.
And no one's like giving me money so I can just go and direct what I want to direct.
Sure.
But I'm wondering what the whole idea, especially as you were getting... You're laying ground for your career in terms of how the MFA program or training itself spoke to you or didn't.
That's a good question. I guess what I encourage for a young director, a director who's at the age where they're making those kind of decisions, is go wherever you have to go and do whatever you have to do to direct. And because, as we were just talking about, there are fewer opportunities to do that because the stakes are so high, because you can't really go and start a little off-Broadway theater company whose budget is $3,000 a month, including the production budget. Because there were fewer opportunities in regional theaters, either because artistic directors direct more because of budgets, or somebody on staff directs the one last production that's available. I think you have to go wherever you can, because ultimately, I think beyond training, which I believe in, ultimately, I think you learn to direct by being a director, by having the chance to get into a room and punch it out with the actors and with that stack of papers called a script and figure it out. So if you can find a good MFA program which is not just theoretical and conceptual and book-based, but is, you know, reality-based, in that you come to this program and you will have a chance to direct 3, 4, 5 productions over the course of your 2 years or 3 years, then that's great.
Right.
That's wonderful. But I would discourage anybody from going into a program that wasn't a practicality-based program, meaning it's about your having the experience of being a director.
And when you work, and how do you work with your, people always ask me, you know, what I do, how I use or work with assistant directors. And I've always been curious about other directors and how they work with their assistant directors, and are there things that you sort of put them in charge of, or is it sort of like, you know, is it a sort of, I need you to just be a third eye in the room, but do you have some sort of... plan when you, or is it just every project requires something different?
I think it's the latter for me. Every project requires something different. Frequently for me, it does fall into the third eye category, which I think is very valuable. I'm not trying to diminish that. I think that's an incredibly valuable thing, because the you can't see the forest for the trees syndrome, or you can't see the trees for the forest syndrome. I have found assistant directors to be really valuable as third eyes about detail things, and tiny little things or inconsistencies or whatever that they can catch because I'm focused on something else that are very important, and and often are the key to much bigger things. So it's frequently that. I'm aware that in many cases I've done things involving younger actors or child actors, and I frequently have used assistant directors in that way to work with the younger actors. Perhaps because they have a bit more patience. But also because they take more hand-holding and more time. Yes. So I frequently use assistant directors that way. In larger musicals, assistant directors, I think, even beyond stage managers, can be valuable just in helping you face the logistics of mounting a big production, of helping you figure out how to use the time.
Right.
You know, and who's going to be where, when, and how many hours. And, you know, particularly as we were just talking about earlier, if you're doing one of those big, big musicals in a short amount of time,
yeah,
somebody needs to remind you of what you have not finished. What has not been done. Right. What is that mountain of work that you haven't even right. approached yet, exactly. and you're teching day after yeah. tomorrow. So, things like that. So, I think it's, for me, it's different every time. I don't have a pro forma about this is what an assistant right. director does.
And I'm going to be skipping around because there's so much
That's
interesting
fine.
Stuff. Do you remember where you were when someone said Pasadena Playhouse? Mm-hmm. And you possibly coming on board to run it? What where were you in your life? And what was that conversation like? And did you go, are you out of your mind? Like, what are you talking about?
Right.
Had you ever been to Pasadena at the time?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, this takes me way back, mm. Robert, actually, because I was born in Los Angeles.
Oh, really?
Yes. I lived in L.A. until I was 11 or 12. And then my father got a job in New York City, so the family moved to Teaneck, New Jersey, mm. but I was born in Los Angeles and raised in L.A. So people think I make this story up because it's just too good a story. But the truth is that one morning, my father was a Presbyterian minister and very much believed in arts exposure for young black kids. So we would go off and see a ballet and go off and see a symphony. So one morning we were loaded onto a bus and made a long trek to this beautiful theater and saw, in one of her last stage performances, I saw Ethel Waters in Member of the Wedding.
Wow.
Certainly an education in divadom.
Right.
And how to take a bow. Amazing. That theater was Pasadena Playhouse.
Mm.
It would be a better story if I could tell you that was the day I decided right. to spend my life in the theater. Not true. But it was a day that I sort of fell in love with going to mm. the theater and having the experience of sitting and watching a play, in that case, a play that had some verisimilitude with my life because it was about a young person.
And were you, how old were you when you saw this
production? I think 11.
And did you understand the significance of Ethel Waters at that time?
No, I didn't understand it historically, mm. but just by that performance, I knew that I was watching somebody pretty important,
mm-hmm.
you know, somebody who knew how to own a stage mm-hmm. and an audience and play the music in incredible ways.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, skipping forward, I then came to New Jersey and continued that habit of going to the theater and became an actor and went to school, as we talked about. And in my freelance career, I was asked to come to Pasadena Playhouse in 1991 to direct On Borrowed Time
mm.
by a friend of mine who was the artistic director at the time, Paul Lazarus.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest, that was around the time when, and you understand this, you know, it's great to have a successful freelance career. But what a successful freelance career means, you never get to stay home.
Yes.
You're always going someplace, coming home, repacking, and going somewhere
yes.
else. And often to great places.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this wonderful run-up to being in Pasadena, where I, you know, I directed at the Guthrie, and I think at Cleveland Playhouse, and a couple of other places. And I was sort of questioning, is this going to be the rest of my life
right.
to, you know, repack my bag every 6 weeks?
Right.
So I did that production. I then, as I was in rehearsal for that production, I was asked to come down to direct a new play in the smaller theater at the Old Globe mm-hmm. by Jack O'Brien. And almost said no, because I was just tired of being out there on the road. Mm. But Jack can be very persuasive, mm-hmm. and was. So I went to do that play, fell in love with the Old Globe Theater, had a great relationship with the Old Globe and with Jack, and applied while I was there for a TCG residency grant, which we got, which then brought me back to the Old Globe for 4 years as associate artistic director.
Okay.
So that was the first time I had a taste of, oh, you can have a home, you can be on a staff, you can live in one place and make a living as a director.
Now the Old Globe.
Yes.
So I associate the Old Globe with incredible amount of entitlement. And an incredible amount of white folks. And an incredible
amount. Do those two go together?
In the theater. Yeah. Yes. And I'm just wondering why the Old Globe for you? And did you see yourself on the stages or behind the stages or even in the even regional theater doing associate artistic director work? Like, mm-hmm. were there role models before that you could point to, or were you sort of saying, what is this thing called associate artistic director?
Yeah.
And what is my role going to be here? You know?
Right.
And why am I in San Diego?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
How did those things play out for you?
Good question. First of all, I guess I have to say, I don't think that I was ever really going to be interested in having a long career as an associate artistic director.
Mm.
I frankly have too much ego for that. But I viewed that residency, I viewed working with Jack as an opportunity to really sort of study, to be a voyeur about what it means to be an artistic director. Because it was something that I thought about, talked with artistic directors when I would guest direct about, but didn't really know what it was or what it meant.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, oh, well, this will be a good opportunity to find out what that is. And Jack offered me tremendous access to anything and everything. And in fact, because that was the beginning of our very profound commercial career for him, he was often not there,
right.
and endowed me with running the theater and said, honey, you got it.
Mm.
And also, because of his particular taste in terms of programming, but also as an incredibly eclectic director, when I got there, Jack just finished directing Hal Holbrook in King Lear, and the next week was starting a production of Damn Yankees.
Mm.
And I said, well, that's the kind of career I want to have. I want to have that kind of eclectic range and possibility. And if I can have that at the Old Globe, fabulous.
Right.
And pretty much I did. You know, I did Noel Coward at the Old Globe, but I also did Play On and Duke Ellington songs, and the first play that I did there was a play with predominantly black characters, and I did Shakespeare, and so Tom Stoppard plays. You know, I had this opportunity of huge range, which again, going back to what we were talking about before, I probably would not have had as a freelance director.
Nah.
But I was in a situation where I could walk into Jack's office and say, I want to do this next season.
Right.
So it allowed me sort of exposure to a wide range of material and artistic possibilities, but also exposure to what it meant to be an artistic director and to run a theater. And it was during that time that the invitation came from Pasadena Playhouse to be artistic director. And I'd enjoyed that. I loved having a home, and I loved the sense of again, going back to putting it together, you know, creating a home for myself, but for other people to work. So when the opportunity came, I knew that Pasadena Playhouse in many ways was a troubled theater, but it was a beautiful physical facility. Mm-hmm. It was in a thriving artistic community of Los Angeles. And I thought I could help it. I thought that I could help make it a better theater because
what
it was a little artistically, it was a little artistically moribund, okay. is my phrase.
Uh-huh.
Paul Lazarus, who had been artistic director, had left. They had not hired another artistic director. So though the theater had programming and it was, you know, it was producing, it was all kind of random and frankly didn't have a whole lot of quality control. It was just happening somehow. So it wasn't very well respected. It had a long history, but in that particular moment was certainly not an admired theater. It had some real financial challenges, many of them going back 10, 15 years before I got there. So I knew it was going to be dicey, you know. I also knew that as they had not had an artistic director in 5 years, I was going to do better than not having one at all. And I just felt that there was potential between the people I worked with over the course of my career and the people who were living in LA, that if you could focus just a little bit more on the work and who was doing the work and who was involved, it could certainly become a better theater than it was, and potentially it could become a great theater. Mm-hmm. So I guess I hubristically took on that challenge. And frankly, at the time that I made the decision to do it, I said, well, I'll do it for 5 years, you know, and then move on to something else. And I always sort of did it in those 5-year increments, and lo and behold, at one point those 5-year increments became 20 years.
Yes.
20 very challenging, frustrating, tiring, but also rewarding and very, very gratifying 2 decades in which I do think I made a difference, and I do think the theater evolved into something greater than it was.
And it was it there that you began a transition into television?
Yes, because I was in, because the theater was based in LA, and I don't think it could have happened any other way. People from the world of television would come to see my work. Interestingly, for example, people said, "Well, how'd you get on Frasier?" You know, part of what they're saying is, you know, how did a black guy wind up directing Frasier?
Right, it's all code.
Yes. And frankly, I don't think it would have happened except for this. I directed in one of my first productions at Pasadena Playhouse was Tom Stoppard's The Real Thing. Incredibly witty, incredibly complicated, all about the words, the language. And one of the creators of Frasier came to see it and immediately approached me in the lobby and said, well, if you can do this Tom Stoppard play, you can do what we do on Frasier. Would you be interested in directing Frasier? I said, hell yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So I spent a long time observing. But it was because the theater was in Los Angeles, based in LA, I was able to move into directing television because it meant I didn't have to leave town to work in TV. Now, it did make for some incredibly long, hard days and juggling what became two good careers.
Mm-hmm.
But it was primarily because of the location of the theater.
And what is, because I know there's a, especially now with all the platforms and, you know, the streaming and the cables and the pods and all that other stuff that's happening, that directors are being asked to do other mediums all the time, you know. And so I'm interested in what you see craft-wise in the difference between television directing and theater directing. And I would actually like to start with your relationship to the actors. Mm. Is there a difference for you in terms of how you approach the actors in the television directing and the actors on the stage?
No, there is not. And I think that that is the thing, that's the thing that I discovered in working in television that was most appreciated by the actors. Mm. Because a lot of television directors come from the technical side. They've been editors, they've been ADs, they've been stage managers, whatever. I remember very, very specifically, I was directing a show, I can't remember which one it was, with great, wonderful actress and wonderful stage actress named Frances Conroy. Mm. And, you know, in television, producers do get up and talk to the actors, and the producer came up and was trying to explain something to her and went on and on and talked.
This is in front of you?
In front of me, okay. Talking to the actor. And I could see that Frances was very confused. And that producer walked away. And I said to Frances, I think all he's trying to say is that your intention is to punish the other character. And she looked at me and she said, oh, you're a director. Quite simply, just because I use the language right. that we use every day in our rehearsals for plays and musicals. Mm-hmm. So no, I think that became my value as a television director was I knew how to help actors. Mm-hmm. I also knew how to help tell the story and working with writers and all of that, but then also using the camera to tell the story. So I think there are probably forms of television which I did not do that are much more complicated technically and visually and explosions and mm-hmm. cars turning over and all of that, that even now I would say I'm not terribly equipped for. But really, the value that I would bring, that you would bring, that any good theater director brings to working in television primarily is working with the actors, you know, and getting them clear on intention, on motivation, on all the who, what, where, whys that we always talk about. That helps them give better performances, you know? Because, again, I would say this, and I have said this, when you walk into a television set, on a television set, there's all these people around doing all of these things, the sound people and the lighting people and the cameramen and the prop people and all of that. All of those people are great at their jobs. There's really only one person among those 100 people who knows how to talk to an actor, and that's a director. Mm. So you better know how to talk to an actor.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And what is your relationship in the television industry to the producer? You know, because in the theater, I think some of the best artistic directors sort of just let you do your job and come in and give observations, but don't sort of like, this is what I would do and this is how I would change it. Right. But they hire the director that they think can do it and they let the director do their job. Right. And ultimately, I think that, you know, there are all these other mechanisms that, in terms of television, in terms of editing, in terms of when the time slot is going to be, in terms of laugh track or anything that sort of like is after you have done the work. Mm-hmm. So I'm interested in sort of like how you negotiate your boss in television as opposed to you negotiate your boss in the theater. Mm-hmm. I mean, and not just a director coming in front of me and speaking directly to an actor would be, you know, crazy.
No, I know. It's an adjustment. It's an adjustment you have to make and accept when you work in television. And first of all, let me say that the way that you described a good artistic director functioning with a guest director is, from my point of view, the right way to function. You know, if you want somebody to direct a play the way you would direct it, you should direct
exactly.
You know, otherwise you should be there to help your guest director get their best version
exactly.
of this production on the stage.
Yeah.
In television, you simply have to accept that. here's the simplest way I can say it: you're number two or three mm-hmm. to producers and writers. And your job is to deliver a version of the show from your point of view, including the editing of it, that you know is then going to be changed by the writers and the executive producer, and maybe even by the network.
Yes.
You know, so that in many cases, what finally winds up on the air may be very different than what you finally delivered. You just have to know that, and you have to accept that. And in the best of cases, you deliver, and this was true of almost every Frasier episode that I did, you deliver what you believe to be the best version of that script. And there may be a few tweaks, but basically when you see it on the air, 2 or 3 months later, it is what you delivered, and that's great. But you... As a director, you just have to shift your brain, shift your thinking, shift your hats, shift all of those things to accept the fact that there's going to be somebody else there who has very strong opinions about what this thing is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Is technically not supposed to speak to actors, but by custom that has become allowed. And again, it's very personality-driven, in my experience, having worked with a lot of showrunners and executive producers. Some are very respectful, and if they have anything to say to the actors, they say it through you.
Mm-hmm.
They let you do your job. They let you find it in your language. And there are others who, you know, want to get in there and try to direct it themselves. And I have... Frankly, hubristically, again, I've said at certain times, if you don't really want me to direct this show, don't hire me again to direct it.
Mm.
You do it.
Mm.
Because if somebody's too pushy or too forward in that way, then there's really no point in your being there.
Right.
So at a certain point, not in my first couple of episodes,
right.
but down the line, when I'd done a lot, I said, you know, This doesn't really work for me. I'm happy to be collaborative
right.
with you and work with you, but I don't work for you
right.
even in television.
Right.
We have to be collaborators.
Right.
But it is very different, and you have to accept that.
There's also, I would imagine, I mean, in the theater, we can sort of close down our room
yes.
and tell a group of people who cannot be in there until we're ready for you to show... for me to show you something or whatever. And I would imagine it's much more public in terms of the work that you have to do. In television, you see you walk into a set and there's a bunch of people doing a bunch of things.
Yes.
And to me, of course, that's called tech. You know? And you sort of get
yes.
there once you're ready for tech.
Yes, that's
work
true.
Yourself up to tech.
That's true.
But, you know, to start the process in tech.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
With 100 people staring.
Right.
As everybody's making bad choices
exactly.
and the wrong decisions.
Right.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and someone talking to the actors and what have you. It's I think it's an exercise in sort of holding your tongue into the right time. You know?
Yeah.
Because, of course, we're given so often this sort of idea that because we are a director, we're supposed to have all the answers. And we're supposed to be the final say and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And what is your sort of relationship to the amount of power that I think that is given the director, especially now in this era where there's been quite clearly a number of people being called out for the exploitation
mm-hmm.
of individuals
yes.
In the room, you know.
Right.
And where do you sit inside your own experience of owning the director's chair, in a way? Do you have experiences in which you could go, you know, maybe now I wouldn't say or do something that where I put myself in this situation with such and such. I always think that, you know, as a director, I run the room in a sort of way that will help the play. And if the play is a slightly outrageous play, then the room is slightly as outrageous, you know.
Yes. But you set the tone.
You set the tone.
Yeah.
But at times, you know, I've asked myself, well, did that, you know, could I have done better? Right. Could I have been a better leader in the room, especially now? And considering, you know, I may want this room to be this way, but someone may actually not need it to be that way today,
right.
You know?
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like,
I do.
Where is that space for you? Where do you sit in that space now?
It's I think it's one of the more complicated things that we have to do, is to create the tone, to create the energy in the room in a way that is good for everybody. And it's hard because you can actually work with people who like a frantic, crazy, fractious room. Mm-hmm. I don't.
Mm-hmm.
My personal philosophy is nothing has ever gotten better because you're in there screaming
right.
6 hours a day,
exactly.
Calling people MFs,
exactly.
And, you know, throwing four-letter words
and just
around.
Taking advantage of everyone in the room.
I just don't think I've never seen anything better because the room was run that way, either in my own running of it or watching directors and artistic director. In fact, in most cases, I've only seen that damage the process. So I tried not to create that atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I do create that atmosphere. But there are people, there are actors, I suppose, who thrive in that kind of atmosphere, with that kind of, one might call it creative abrasion.
Yeah.
You know? And so sometimes you've also got to honor that, but monitor that.
Yes.
You know? And say, okay, we've allowed that.
Yeah, you've taken up all the space that you can take up today.
But yes, we all need to breathe now.
Right.
So let the rest of us have a little bit of air.
Right,
you
right.
know, or we let that flame ignite for a while, but now we need to damp that down.
Yes.
And see how we can move that energy into something that is creative and productive. I used to be rather afraid of any conflict in a room. But you get to a point where you say, okay, well, maybe a little conflict in a room now is not so bad, you know? And maybe a good, respective, healthy, either argument or heated discussion about something is okay, you know? And we'll survive it, you know? And we'll get through the day. And at the end of the day, you acknowledge, you say, well, that was kind of hot and heavy, but hey, we learned something from it.
Mm-hmm.
We grew from it. And maybe we won't have to have that same argument tomorrow, which is good. So, I think that, you know, we often say the directing is about time management, but it's also about people management. And it's about, it is very much about psychology and sort of, you know, being a psychologist to each individual actor, but to the company as well. I've not had to fire many people over a long career, but once or twice I've had to say, this person is trying to overwhelm this process due to their personal needs. I'm going to have a chat with this person about that. And if it gets better, fine. But if it happens one more time, that person has to go. And I've let that person go.
And have you ever had to do that as an artistic director to a director?
Fortunately, only once. Only when it became, interestingly, not so damaging to the actors in the company, but to the production staff of the theater, where the person was so disrespectful and so abusive to people I was later going to have to work with, you know, to my family. Basically, to my artistic family at the theater, I spoke to the person and said, I understand the tensions of what you're doing. I understand the stress of what you're doing. But this is my family.
Right.
You're going to be gone in 2 weeks, but these people are going to be here for the rest of the season. Mm-hmm. I cannot have these people treated that way. And if that continues, I'm not going to get rid of them. But you will have to go.
And do you think that this was something that the director carried from production to production? Or was this a particularly your family that sort of set it off? But this was their MO?
Yeah. Usually in situations like that, with a director who behaves that way, or choreographer, or designer, for mm-hmm. that matter, if... You may know it by reputation before the person comes in, and you say, well, you know, I can make a difference this
way. Right.
But if you didn't know it, and if you do a little checking around after the fact mm-hmm. and call another artistic director, you usually find out, oh, yeah, that's them. Mm. That's him or her. Mm. That's the way they behave.
I see.
You know, that's the way they move through the world. And if the person is brilliant enough, it's often allowed.
Yes.
But in most cases, even with people who are talented, I've seen good people's careers go down in flames
mm.
because of bad behavior.
Mm.
Because they just handle the difficult, stressful work that we do, they handle it in the wrong way.
Yeah.
And they've crashed and burned their own careers.
Do you think that you want to be a artistic director of any union?
Wow. I don't think so.
Mm.
I had an extraordinary experience. I had a long experience. 20 years is a long time. I think it's, as is happening right now in the American theater, I think it's time for another generation, mm. your generation,
mm.
to have those jobs and to lead those theaters and lead the field to new places. So no, I think that's doubtful.
Mm.
I think I've done that, I guess is what I would say.
And what do you think of the turnover that's been happening? I say turnover in a sort of like, as we sit in, you know, New York City, where ain't nobody turning over nothing.
You know, where so true.
These people are going to die with their dead cold hands so at true. The gate.
Right.
You know,
which, by the way, I didn't want to be one of those people. Right. You know, they say, what do we have to do to get him out of here?
Exactly.
You know? Yeah, what's it going to take?
Put this thing in front of him and see if he'll follow it out.
Yeah.
But what do you think? I mean, you have Nataki taking over OSF, which is sort
yes.
of extraordinarily amazing.
Wonderful.
You know, do you have any sort of advice or any sort of cheerleading to give to these, you know, Maria and Wooly and the different people who are stepping into roles that are traditionally held not only by men, but by white people?
Yes.
And of course, coming into Pasadena Playhouse, I can only imagine there was a long history of white people before you.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you can give or that you can say to those people walking into these spaces that are traditionally white?
Yeah.
And taking control and also taking the blame,
yes.
really, for a lot of stuff.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Here's what I would say. Acknowledge the fact that because you are a person of color stepping into a situation or situations that have not been filled by a person of color previously or ever in many cases, especially with these larger theaters, acknowledge the fact that there are going to be people who are waiting for you to fail.
Mm.
Acknowledge the fact that there are people who assume that you can only fail
mm.
because you're not going to be up to it. Acknowledge the fact that there are people who want you to fail
yes.
to prove that you're not up to it. Acknowledge all of that. Be a little bit intimidated by all of that. A little nervous about that, and then get over it and do what you do, and your success will be the best and only argument that you have to make. Your being there for a few years and making your theater thrive and grow and be artistically sound and perhaps, you know, artistically superior to what it's been before will be the best and only argument that you have to make.
Now that's really wonderful, actually. You know, I like that idea of acknowledging it.
Because it's there.
Yeah. And it's probably...
Pretending it's not there is not helpful.
No. And it won't
show up. Because you spent too much time going, oh, what was that?
Exactly.
What's that dagger in my back?
Exactly. Why all these knives hanging over my head? But also, I just think that, like, you know, in many cases, it won't come at you to your face.
Oh, it's covert.
It will not come at you in blatant racism.
That's right.
Or homophobia.
That's right.
Or sexism. Yes. It will come with a pat on your back.
Yes.
You know, and a wink and an eye.
Right.
And you know,
a whisper over in a corner.
Exactly. Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And something that's sort of like, you know, a sigh even, you know, over a decision, you know. Mm-hmm. And that you can't sort of fight all those battles, you know, at the same time, but they need to be acknowledged.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah. Because they're realities.
Yes.
You know, we'd like to think, or we're all in this, you know, post-Obama, we're
exactly.
all in a together era.
Yeah.
It's quite clearly been proven that
Wrong.
We are not.
Exactly.
So, you know, as you would acknowledge any other reality,
yes.
you know, a fiscal reality,
yes.
a budgetary reality, acknowledge that reality and move past it.
Yes.
Because you can't do anything about that.
Right.
It's not your job to walk in and change people's previous
exactly.
prejudices.
Right.
Your job is to be there and do the work.
Right.
But acknowledge the fact that people have prejudices and then let it go.
Right. And don't live inside this sort of fantasy.
Right.
You know, that everyone is here for your benefit and we're not the best for you.
Right.
Because that simply is not true.
Yeah. No,
you
it's
know?
Not. It's amazing the number of times when we you know, you get confused by something and you,
right.
you know, you go home and you think about it and you talk to your friends. You say, what was that? What? Oh, that was racism.
Yeah, that was racism, by the way.
Okay,
now,
got it.
Wait, now
move
drink your wine and keep it moving.
Exactly.
That little part right there,
that
was racism.
That was homophobia. That was whatever, that was
right.
sexism.
Exactly.
Got it.
That was all there, yeah.
Right. That's
exactly.
Who, and then you know, that's who that person is.
Right.
Great.
Exactly.
Much
now
easier to deal with.
Exactly. Now let's talk a little bit about the foundation. We sit in SDC here. And I know that you have been not only a part of SDC, but a champion of the SDC.
Yes.
And the foundation. So what is actually the difference between the union and the foundation?
The union is a union.
Okay.
It's about the business side of the work of directors. It's also emotionally supportive and artistically supportive, but it's about working. It's about our contracts
yes.
and negotiating our contracts and what are we going to get paid and, you know, making sure that we get paid, the environment
yes.
and all of those things. The foundation, I would say, is hopefully the warm, welcoming hug of the family of directors and choreographers in this country. We are there to, the foundation is there to nurture, to educate, to cultivate, to support, and to sustain directors and choreographers at all stages of their careers. So to provide training opportunities, informational opportunities, workshop opportunities for directors of all ages, if you want to participate, but specifically geared towards younger directors, to honor directors who've had long careers here in the commercial theater, but also in regional theater and in smaller theaters. And then to find ways to sustain mid-career directors who are facing challenging points where they're saying, can I keep going?
Right.
You know, how do I sustain myself? How
right.
do I keep myself fired up and,
right.
and going economically, artistically, all of those things?
Mm-hmm.
So the foundation provides this vast array of programming looking to meet those needs for practitioners of the theater at all stages. And from my point of view, in that way, not only are we serving those individual directors and choreographers, we're serving the field, because I believe that the field is healthy when we as directors and choreographers are healthy and prepared to do the work.
Yes.
To run the theaters, to produce productions, to direct productions, to create productions. A healthy field of directors and choreographers who know how to be good collaborators, as we've talked about, is good for the American theater field and for the world theater field, for that matter. So in some ways, the foundation is serving individuals, hopefully, in a healthy way, but also remarkably important to the field, and that's why it's been so important to me.
Mm. And as the chair, what is do you feel is the most important aspect of your job as a chair in terms of as it relates to directors and their personal lives? What holds you to the flame, if you will, that this is why I am doing this, and this is why. Because, I mean, as a director, we have so many things pulling on us, right?
Right.
And then to take on not only an outside position, but also a position that actually has you interact with hundreds, if not thousands, of directors. I mean, the idea of being in the room with directors is somehow sort of like, real. I'm back in graduate school, whatever, it's just like, directors can be very, very difficult.
Yes.
You know, and personality-wise, you know.
High maintenance.
High maintenance, right?
Yes, absolutely.
But what keeps you going in terms of your relationship to being the chair of the foundation and the directors themselves?
Okay. There are two things that I'm very focused on as the chair. So I'll tell you what those two things are, and then I'll tell you why I do it. The first thing is entirely practical and entirely necessary, and that is helping to raise funds to sustain the foundation.
Mm.
Many people make the assumption that the foundation is entirely funded by the union. Mm. It is not. The union, there is a part of the union budget that is a substantial gift to the foundation, but it is by far not 100% of the foundation's budget.
Mm.
So we have to raise money. We have to raise money from individuals, from foundations, from corporations, all of that. So a big part of my job as chair is with the executive director is to lead that charge.
Yes.
Get out there and let that message be known, and then to find those individuals, those corporations and foundations who will respond to that call. One of the things that's been important to me as chair is to make sure that we listen to the membership. A lot of the programs of the foundation have been around for a long time and are great programs. But I want to make sure that I don't feel that way, and the executive director doesn't feel that way in singularity, that the membership also feels that way. You know, tell us if these programs are really what you want and need.
Right.
Tell us if they're not. don't let us be hubristic enough to make assumptions about what you need.
Right.
Or tell us if those programs are great, but you need something else, you know? Particularly in that mid-career area. Very interested in hearing more from mid-career directors about what is it that we can do to help sustain you. And we have, fortunately, a big research project that we're just about to embark on. And it's all about listening to the membership, hearing from directors of all ages and all over the country about what it is you want and need from a foundation. And here's why I do it. As we've talked about, I am so lucky, Robert, to be the beneficiary of a lineage system of great mentors like Jack O'Brien, Lloyd Richards, Hal Scott, mm-hmm. you know, who was an artistic director at a theater long before any black man or woman had been an artistic director. Israel Hicks, mm-hmm. who was both my teacher and my wonderful friend. I'm so lucky to have had the chance to have exposure to those masters of the art of direction, but also masters of leadership of institutions. Mm. Through a number of circumstances, I was lucky enough to spend real personal time with Bob Fosse at one point in my life. I mean, hours and hours in time, and to the point where I was sitting there going, well, why is Bob Fosse talking to me for all of this time? So I believe in that passing it on. I believe in the value of that system of lineage and of mentorship. And I believe in the fact that it is reciprocal. That, you know, the younger has as much to teach the older as the older does to the younger. So the value of our getting out of the rehearsal room and having places to gather, having places to talk, having places to do the kind of complaining that actors go off to and leave you sitting in the room alone.
Right.
Is sustaining, is valuable, is educational, and helps us all to evolve, helps us all to become better artists. So that's why it's so important to me. And it is a lot of work. It's a lot of work, but very, very satisfying and very rewarding.
Mm. Well, you know, this is also so fascinating because, you know, people have asked me about people that I can see in the industry that look like me and that have journeys through their career that I find emblematic, what have you. And certainly yours being one, and George being another, and Kerry Perloff, you know, it's like it's all these different people that sort of like you have to sort of like acknowledge, you know, because of the doors that you guys open, you know, and the women that everyone opens, and that no one sort of like gets into a position in a void.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
And there's always, you know, I've been fascinated speaking with you about, you know, because of the career of being an actor, being starting a theater, being a director, and then going on and doing Broadway, and then doing television, you know, and now doing the foundation. I'm wondering what else is there that you want to do?
Rest and relaxation.
Right.
Vacation.
Yeah.
No, thank you, first of all. That's very generous of you. And in explanation, again, I'm just reminded of the great Sidney Poitier quote when he got one of his Oscars. He said, you know, I'm only here because I was able to stand on the shoulders of those who went before me. And that is so true for all of us. You know, in that list of things you just went through, I've been so blessed and so fortunate to do most of the things that I ever dreamed of doing. Almost all of the things that I ever dreamed of doing. So now I have the wonderful opportunity to move forward in the next few years by choice. And that is a rare and wonderful opportunity. And I realize that, and I'm grateful for that. Because so often, either internal or external pressures make us choose things that frequently we might not want to do.
Right.
But we get afraid of saying no. If I say no, I'll never work again.
Right, yeah.
You know, I don't have that pressure at all.
The value of saying no, I think, is highly underestimated.
No is a very important tool.
It is.
Including knowing that something's just not right for you.
Right.
There's somebody else who will do that better than you.
Exactly.
So let them do it.
Right. And I always tell actors, like, you have to try and fall in love with the word now.
Yeah.
Because you're going to hear that often.
Yes.
And so many, I think, especially up-and-coming directors, they're like, oh, I can't not do this because it's been offered to me.
Right.
You know, so I have to do... I can't imagine doing... And people think I work a lot, but I can't imagine doing 8 productions.
I know.
And it's, that sounds exhausting. Crazy. Yeah. To
Between
me.
last September and the beginning of April... Now, having an opportunity to go back to freelancing, being free of an institution, unburdened, as I said to Carrie Perloff, I did 5 productions.
That's a lot.
And I went, whoa.
That's a lot.
This is exhausting. So when I got to April, I said, I'm so happy not to have anything in the next few months.
Yeah.
Thank goodness.
Right.
So, yeah, I'm thrilled to have the opportunity to keep moving forward by choice and, as we were talking about with the foundation, to be of service to others, you know, I know how hard this work is.
Oh,
I know
very
how hard. Hard this career making is. I know specifically how hard this career making is for artists of color and for women.
Yes.
If I can be of some value in sustaining those young careers or older or mid-level careers and encouraging people to stay with it for as long as they want to, I'm happy, happy to do that.
Mm. And finally, I just want to ask you about your work in the education sector as a teacher. And is there a particular... type of class that you like to teach, or is there something that you find exciting about teaching young students or whatever the theater? Mm-hmm. I always say, you know, that it's one of the only professions in which we sort of allow kids to sort of participate in. Mm-hmm. Like, no one's going to a kid, oh, can you operate on your friend today? Or can you try this case for me? But everyone's going to a kid, yeah, you can just go up there and do the show.
Be an actor.
Just be an actor. Right. Pick up the pen. And then you end up with this sort of, like, you know, a fantastical view with adults going, oh, I can just do that. I can, you know, if they're doing it, I can do it, you know? Mm-hmm. And that there's a sort of, like, because my, you know, when my grandmother was alive, I would always go, you know, my grandmother has an opinion about my job. Right. Like, she could watch a show and, like, oh, yeah, didn't like it. That's boring.
Everybody's
a critic. I don't know if you did the operation well or not,
right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But in my job, also, I am publicly humiliated on a regular basis, you know, for all the world to see. And I'm wondering how you then negotiate teaching kids about, oh, yeah, this is actually a profession.
Right.
And not a hobby.
Right.
You know.
Well, I think your medical world comparison is very apt.
Mm.
You know, it is a profession. We have techniques.
Mm.
We have skills. We have knowledge of practical realities of how to make things work or not work. It's not all magic.
Right.
There is a certain level of magic to it, and you hope that will enter the room with every production that you do. But some of it is just skill.
Yes.
You know, it's just knowing, you know, that doctor has to know where to make that cut.
Yes.
And how big it should be.
Right.
You know, and
how to sew you back up.
How to sew you back up at the end of that operation, and hopefully not have left anything bad in there.
Right, exactly.
So, you know, that's very apt. And that's the kind of, when I'm teaching... that is the kind of very practical, bottom line, skill-based information that I try to offer.
Mm.
And based on, not concept, but based on what I have learned as a practitioner, as a guy who's done a lot of operations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so when I'm talking to... management students at Yale, where I teach, or if I'm guest teaching at a university and talking to actors, that's what I'm trying to offer.
Mm.
You know, it's not theoretical, it's not highfalutin, it's very earth terra firma based, and that's the value that I have, that you know, I'm willing to be really honest about the glories of this profession, but also about the nadirs of this profession and what's tough about it and what you better be ready to face and what you'd better be expecting when you get out there, because these university environments are very, very cozy.
Yes.
And you dast not come out of here thinking you know everything.
Right.
Which is a great danger that we've seen. So, you know, humility is one of the things that I teach because I struggle to be humble because I believe it's so important.
Yeah. I tell my students, you know, I said, no one is waiting for you. There's no one outside this door waiting for you to come out.
Right. So don't fool yourself into believing that.
No, you have to be waiting for yourself.
Yes.
You have to be waiting for the person you want to be
yes.
and the career that you want outside that door, because no one else is waiting for you.
So true.
And I mean, I think that it's been a thrill to speak with you, because I think that so often as directors, we're wrapped up in our own careers, and we don't my interactions are with actors and with designers and with producers and with audience members, but it's rarely with other directors.
Yes.
And it's certainly not with a director of note who's done all of this other stuff, you know. And so this has been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Robert. It's been great to talk to you.
Yes.
Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by SDC Foundation. SDC Foundation events and programs are designed to offer access, opportunity, and community to directors and choreographers at all levels of their careers. To find out more, visit our website at www.sdcfoundation.org.